To quote Bishop Leslie Newbegin, you cannot have hopeful and responsible action without some vision of a possible future. In other words, if there is no point in the story as a whole, there's no point in any individual's action. If the story or the context of which I am part is meaningless, any action of mine is meaningless. The loss, he goes on to say, the loss of a vision for the future often produces that typical phenomenon in our society which the sociologists call anomie, a state in which publicly accepted norms and values disappear. In today's gospel reading, Jesus offers a very clear vision, a very clear statement to his disciples. Paraphrased, it goes like this: God has loved me, I have loved you. Love one another as I have loved you. You are no longer servants, you are my friends. There is no greater love than to lay down your life for a friend. I have chosen you to do God's work, and God has and will support you in that work. As a soundbite, that would go something like this: trust me, join me, love one another. This is pretty much what the disciples went on to do, in fact. In this manner, the fledgling church grew, and exponentially so, into what can be regarded as Western civilization, embraced a common vision of a possible future, the reign of God universal. Now, some encapsulated that vision in the concept of the city of God, the new Zion. Now, cities have not always been a useful image. Often cities have been seen as the last place that God would want to be associated with. Babylon, Rome, Sodom, Nineveh, Wellington. No, just kidding. Some even hold that view today. However, it was, of course, in a city that Jesus triumphed, where in challenging that city to its very roots, he demonstrated a love that had never before been imagined. And it is, of course, a city that we're called to work out our vision. Active Christians, it seems, are few in our city. Look around us now and you'll not see many who live within 3 km of our bell tower here today. But look also around our neighbourhood and you'll see a grid of roads, tall buildings that accommodate a huge variety of activity: commercial, industrial, leisure, residential, administrative, and so on. All this human activity, much of it relatively new, energetic, sometimes dangerous, sometimes hidden, sometimes welcoming, sometimes confusing, always diverse. And it is that diversity that creates for us a sure challenge. This city society of ours is remarkably fragmented. No longer can we easily imagine what the makeup of our neighbourhood consists of. Now, this is neither bad nor good, it just is, but it does make understanding it a little bit more difficult. And the concepts of neighbourhood, of local community in the city, becomes much less a powerful element in people's lives. And so it's much more difficult for any church to relate to the whole community that surrounds it. The clergy are often tempted to look after those individuals and families who attend the church, and they in turn expect the clergy to spend their time doing so. The vision of the church as a body which exists for the neighbourhood and not just for its members, as the sign of God's rule over all, is much harder to sustain. Yet as a church, we are required to sustain that vision. And by that I take the New Testament understanding of church to mean the church of God or of Christ and the church of a place. In other words, the worshipping assembly called forth by God in this place. Now, two things could happen to the vision if either of these two elements of understanding church become neglected. The congregation may be so identified with the place, so concerned with its own goings on, that it ceases to be the vehicle of God's involvement with that place. Or it may be so concerned about the relationship of its members to God that it turns its back on the neighborhood and is perceived as irrelevant to its concerns. Furthermore, with the development of secular or denominational agencies for social action, it can happen that social activism is no longer seen as the direct responsibility of the local congregation, other than when they're called upon for financial support. But if the local congregation is not perceived in its own neighborhood as the place from which good news overflows in good action, the programs for social and political action initiated by the various denominational social service agencies or organizations will lose their integral relationship to the good news and come to be seen as part, perhaps, of a moral crusade, a purely social good works organization, or even the outworking of a special interest group, rather than part of the gospel enterprise. In the last few years, we've seen many of the various denominational social service agencies separate out from their congregations and the church bodies that originally formed them. Often the association of a particular denomination with a particular social agencies was seen as undesirable, somehow less inviting to those who might need the service, but were not Anglicans or Presbyterians or Methodists or even Christians for that matter. Often this move to separation was initiated by a desire to put social service organizations on a proper professional footing, a proper business model driven basis, and initially it seemed to work. However, much recent retrenchment and the selling off of rest homes, for instance, seems to have left the business model in a rather tatty condition. All too often today, we have church-originated social services in which one would be hard-pressed to find any connection to those who founded them. In this way, those organizations are deprived of something greater than they could achieve and be by themselves, as are those congregations that originally established and until relatively recently wholeheartedly claimed them. All too often, social service agencies today follow the donor dollar, in many cases the funding that is provided by the state, especially in the areas of child and youth services. All too often, social service agencies cast off or sell off those services that receive insufficient government funding. The original need for those services is still there. The practical financial considerations do not seem to be valid anymore. Now, I'm pleased to reassure you that this trend has not taken a strong footing within Anglican social services, who are, incidentally, the largest provider of any of the denominational social service providers. That does not mean, however, that all is well. We Anglicans have lost much ground in working out how we can remain in close connection with those social service organizations of which we once were closely and intimately linked. Now, this raising of the issue is probably heresy to all social service CEOs, and I haven't run this by Diane yet, but in my opinion, it is true. And talking of heresy, before you begin to accuse me of descending into that English one, that of Pelagianism, I hasten to add a warning that in laying too much stress on our own activities, laudable though they may be, we diminish the life and work of Christ by allowing too little of our activities to be controlled by the sense of the greatness and the sufficiency of God. We must, of course, take up social and even evangelical works within our community, our neighborhood, if you will, in a very practical and energetic way. Yet if we are to do this in an authentic Christian way, this is where the trust thing of the soundbite becomes really important. As the disciples found out, probably initially to their great discomfort, they were chosen by Christ. They didn't offer themselves. They didn't come first. They didn't put their hands up. We, in the same way, have already been chosen. But chosen not in the sense of the elect, for instance, has often been portrayed in recent literature and movies, but chosen in the sense that the way has already been prepared for us, and we just need to find the road. We are required to trust in the vision offered by Christ, and with that trust, get on with it. Well, what is it that we're meant to sort of get on with? Not quite sure, actually. Clearly we, and as I have mentioned before, need to take in the concerns and the difficulties of our neighbours. But exactly who are they? And what are those concerns? And how do we find them out? I don't really know what the locals might need or want. I've some idea, and I'm not sure whether you do either. I'm not even sure how we go about finding that out, or even if we should. You see, that's that trust thing working again, and in this context, it's a lack of trust that motivates me. I get worried sometimes, I get anxious, I get timid. It's my timidity and anxiety that brings back or holds back the trust. Timidity in imagining that something could happen, that it's all just too hard. Anxiety about being too pushy as a church, as a Christian. Anxiety about being seen as a typical of a failing religious remnant of a discredited past, poking my nose in secular matters that do not concern me. However, if I work past that timidity and anxiety and start to think of some options, let me just run through a couple for you. Not far from here, up on K Road, there's a wonderfully eclectic group of workers headed by Kay in the Prostitutes Collective. And I just sort of wondered one day what it might be like to put on a morning tea for the collective. I'd suggest we do the morning tea first and then invite them to the service afterwards, because they do enjoy eating. But I just wonder how that might speak to them. I would suspect there's very few churches that have made the offer before. So I think it'd be a wonderful thing to try. I wonder how many cleaners go past this building at 4, 5 in the morning, having cleaned ASB Tower and all the buildings around here, and go home to Otara and Mangere and think, I wonder what happens in that church. How often do the street sweepers and cleaners go past, thinking, what a bloody mess is outside St. Matthew's again? And if we're to ask them, perhaps, one day to come in. Now, the list goes on. One more that I'll fly by you. What about a concert just for locals? You've got to be in your local room key to get entrance. Free concert. May sound a little trite. Poor example of just trying to drum up trade, if you were. But stick with it. Could we then follow that up with the same mailing list with other ventures? We have a lot of students, Asian students, up and down these streets, perhaps English classes, introductions to Kiwi culture. I'm quite happy to do that part that takes them over to the Albion and introduces them to that aspect of Kiwi culture. The bicultural element, Kiwi slang, questions and answers. In fact, I guess in some ways it doesn't matter what the activity is. It's us going out. It's us putting that anxiety, putting that fear behind us and reaching out in some way. You see, it's that sound bite again. Trust me, join me, love one another. You sort of wonder, I presume, there has been somebody who's written a book about all of this. In fact, I'm sure there's dozens of them. But it's trust that's the main thing, not the knowledge of how to do it, but that trust me, join me, love one another. See, I'm reminded that of all the books around, Jesus never wrote one of them, but he did form a community. So let's just trust in our community. You see, the traverse that uncharted ground needs a certain state of the heart. When Jesus made the distinction from servant to friend, he took the disciples to a new level of relationship, which in turn demanded that they join him in his vision. Friends share each other's visions. Furthermore, friends usually act on a shared vision, not out of legal obligation as a servant must towards a master, but out of a moral obligation driven by a love of that friend. Now, this is where the rubber really meets the road. As Christians, we have no choice but to act on the shared vision of Jesus. That's if we dare to be a friend of the Christ.